Stokely Carmichael, the charismatic and controversial black activist, changed American history when he called for black power in Mississippi in 1966. A major figure in the civil rights and black power movements, Carmichael pushed Martin Luther King Jr. to oppose Vietnam and made the Black Panther Party a household name. Yet, oddly enough, there has never been a definitive biography about him. Enter Peniel Joseph, who corrects that situation with his new biography, Stokely, A Life. In the book, Joseph uses Carmichael's life as a prism through which to view the African-American freedom struggles that transformed the 20th century. Peniel Joseph is a professor of history and founding director of the Center for Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to Stokely as a subject and to right a wrong?
Well, I first heard about Stokely Carmichael growing up in New York City, and I saw him really for the first time on the Eyes on the Prize television documentary in the 1980s when I was still in junior high school. So I really was captivated and inspired by him and his message. And as I developed further politically, was very much interested in who he was, both as an intellectual, as an activist, and in the literature that came out, with the exception of his own autobiography that was published posthumously in 2003, there really wasn't a full vetting of who Carmichael Kwame Ture was and who he became, his legacy. No one discussed his civil rights activism, and he sort of just appears as the young activist who calls for black power and then sort of disappears soon after. And I wanted to really see him in a larger context.
How did he come to the position that he had initially with Dr. Martin Luther King and come into that inner circle?
Well, he's a young activist even before King. He meets King. He meets up with Dr. King in 1963, but it's important to remember Stokely is born in Port of Spain, Trinidad. So he's an immigrant, and he comes to the United States in 1952. He's 10 years old, a couple of weeks before his 11th birthday, and he becomes politicized even in Port of Spain, Trinidad. His parents are his grandparents raise him, his aunts, and then he comes and gets reunited with his mother and father in New York City. And his background is about social and political justice. He becomes mentored by Bayard Rustin, the civil rights activist, in the 1950s. So he goes to Bronx Science High School, which was one of the best high schools in New York City, predominantly white, predominantly Jewish, very political, very left, very progressive. And so he's imbibing all these different cultures of sort of both a predominantly left white culture, but also an African-American, Pan-Africanist culture via family in Harlem, listening to Miriam Makeba and international music. And this is all before he enters college. So by the time he enters Howard University in 1960, he's very political. He joins the sit-in movement. He joins the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he becomes a militant nonviolent activist. So he is in all these demonstrations, never fights back. He's very, very disciplined. But Stokely Carmichael's nonviolence is tactical, and it's not spiritual or philosophical. It's a tactical movement. So he becomes a well-known organizer in Mississippi, in Alabama. People know who Stokely Carmichael is. Martin King knows who he is. Bob Moses of SNCC, who helps organize Mississippi as well, knows who he is. Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer. And what's interesting is that before the Black Power call, he serves as Dr. King's chauffeur and bodyguard in Greenwood, Mississippi in 1964. So as soon as he graduates from Howard University, he starts to live in Mississippi full time. But he had first encountered Mississippi in 1961. So he spends every summer in Mississippi between 61 and 64. And he was first arrested in Mississippi as a freedom rider June 8, 1961. So he's somebody who everybody knows in the movement. He marches with Dr. King in Selma, Alabama. He organizes the first original Black Panther Party in Lowndes County, Alabama, which is a political group, Lowndes County Freedom Organization, that's nicknamed the Black Panthers. And then he popularizes the Black Panther Party for self-defense. So what's interesting about Carmichael is that even before the Black Power fame, movement activists know, if you say Stokely Carmichael, they know who that is. It's just that after the call for Black Power, the United States and the whole world knows who he is.
You write in the book that he, as you mentioned, he spent his 20th birthday in jail, and he would later note that he spent many times in southern jails and many birthdays in southern jails. And that was part of the movement and part of what he was doing, part of the process, right?
Yeah, it was a rite of passage. It's very interesting how in an interview by the 1980s as Kwame Ture, he says when he's asked to describe what did SNCC experience in the South, he says that what he experienced in the South and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he called it raw terror. And I've always been struck by that, those words, where he said that what he experienced was raw terror, because he was arrested 27 times between 1961 and 66, beaten, brutalized. He's been chased down at driving 120 miles per hour with people in the car to escape the same fate that happened to Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, the activists who were martyred during Mississippi Freedom Summer. So he really experienced the kind of trauma that people face on enemy lines in wartime. So it's very interesting to me that he was very much interested in sacrifice and willing to suffer for this idea of change and transformation and revolution.
It is very compelling to read your description of his relationship with Dr. Martin Luther King. It is an interesting relationship because the men have much in common as far as common ground, but their thoughts and their ways of going about it are very different. And King is certainly much more aware of perhaps how things would go over better, and that sets up an interesting dynamic between the two men.
Yeah, there's a real brotherly love between them, and almost fatherly love in the sense that King is 12 and a half years older than Stokely. He invites him to his home for dinner in Atlanta. They march on the Meredith March together, but they had known each other for 3 years, but become very, very close friends. On the front lines in Mississippi. They never publicly disparage each other. Stokely will always say that Dr. King taught him and black people how to face racial terror without fear, because he always admired King's fearlessness and also King's love for black people. But then Stokely impacts King, his anti-war activism. I think one of the most interesting parts of doing research on him is how big of an anti-Vietnam War figure he actually was when we look at those times. Because I hadn't realized that going into the project that, the State Department, Lyndon Johnson's White House, the FBI, the Justice Department, they're all looking at his anti-war speeches. And it's Stokely who popularizes the phrase, "Hell no, we won't go." So before King and before Muhammad Ali come out against the war in 67, it's Stokely who's leading thousands of students at Berkeley, at historically black colleges, white schools, in anti-war protests. And it's really remarkable. So he pushes King to come out against the war. And one great anecdote is that King comes out against the war April 4th, 1967, in Riverside, New York, at the Riverside Church. And what's interesting is that 11 days later, he's marching with Stokely in a massive anti-war demonstration at the United Nations, from Central Park to United Nations. Dr. Benjamin Spock is there, Harry Belafonte, and they both give speeches, but everybody says that Stokely really steals the show with a real, real denunciation on American imperialism, American empire, racism, calling the war in Vietnam racist. Lyndon Johnson, he's not going to fight in the racist war. And afterwards, at Harry Belafonte's apartment, sprawling New York City apartment, Stokely is teasing Dr. King about how, it's his example that King is following in this case, right? And a couple of weeks later, King calls him up in Atlanta and says, "Stokely, I want you to come to my church." And Stokely says that, "I'm not going to come like a good heathen. I'm going to be working for the people." And King says, "Stokely, I really want you to come to my church." And he says, "Why?" And he says, "I'm really going to come out against the war in the kind of forceful way that you've been, talking about." And Stokely says, I'm going to be in the front pew of your church." And there's actual footage of King at Ebenezer last Sunday in April coming out very, very strong against the Vietnam War. And Stokely Carmichael is leading the standing ovation to King's speech.
Talk a little bit about his membership and ultimately chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He did a lot of work and certainly was an organizer of Freedom Summer, but was also saddled with press that he was not inclusive and was kicking whites out of that organization.
Yeah, and the thing is, one thing I argue in the book is that he did not kick whites out of SNCC. I mean, there's a vote 19-18 that says that, you know, any white person still working with SNCC can't work under the SNCC banner. They can continue their activism, and Stokely was actually against that. So his personal relationship with whites was always very good, and even after the Black Power call, he keeps up these intimate relationships and friendships. What he does have, however, is a critique against institutional racism and white liberal condescension, in the sense that the idea that whites would say, and sort of define the Black movement and say what was too violent, what was not, where could alliances be forged and where they could not. So he makes an argument that white activists should be working in the white community, because that's where anti-racist struggle really needs to be shaping, and that there can be political coalitions, but those coalitions have to be based on shared trust and not some kind of unequal power relationship. So I think one of the biggest misconceptions is this idea that Stokely was anti-white. It's really, he had a critique of white paternalism, and he had a critique of he talked about the counterculture. He said the counterculture was just doing it for a little while, and then they were all going to be investment bankers. And he wasn't too far off. So he had a critique of white identity and white privilege in that sense. But he did not have any personal animus. Interviewing people, you really see that. So many people who are white colleagues and friends of Stokely, from Bronx Science to SNCC, will say that, you know, he was always interracial in terms of his relationships and his view of the world.
Peniel Joseph is the author of the new biography, Stokely, A Life. It is published by Basic Books. How much do you believe he was fueled by anger?
Well, you know, I think that anger is part of the fuel. I think that certainly seeing people get killed, being arrested himself, he lived and worked among poor Black sharecroppers, the kind of people who lived in the Mississippi Delta, who never had birth certificates, never would have certificates of death. And that's real. That's the reality. So that's a shocking aspect of American life if you're educated and if you're coming from sort of different backgrounds. So there was anger at inequality and anger at violence, but he's really inspired by a deep, deep love and compassion for poor people and for underdogs. You know, the reason why he's going to move to Africa and become Kwame Ture, part of it is because of FBI harassment and federal government surveillance, but part of it is also because of a real feeling of love and kinship with poor people. People who are on the margins, people who are struggling, but people who want political, social, economic, cultural transformation and revolution. So I think that, yes, he was angry, and that's part of his persona, but it's not the only part of his persona, and I think it's been overplayed, because, I mean, he was, after all, an intellectual. I mean, what's great about doing research on him is that you see footage of Stokely Carmichael at 23, 24, 25 on, Meet the Press and Face the Nation and the Today Show, and you're mesmerized because he is parrying with journalists and PhDs, and he is, you know, more than holding his own. He's brilliant and erudite, right? So this is not your average political activist in any way, shape, or form.
And after King's assassination, I mean, he would really go on a college campus and was mobbed like a rock star.
Yeah, he was. And I call him Black Power's rock star, not in a way to be dismissive, but to really explain and evoke the massive convergence between politics and celebrity in the 1960s in a way that we don't have today, because it would almost be like, you know, somebody who's very, very popular also being a political activist, right? And you don't really have that. We sort of have separated that. Celebrities do one thing and people who are activists do another. Whereas with Stokely's case, he was the guy, you know, he was a magazine cover person. He was somebody who was considered very, very handsome and sexy and charming, with a great sense of humor. So it was very magnetic, very charismatic, both in public and private. So that's the interesting part of his persona. So he's very easy with the media and really took a lot of the attention in stride, but certainly wherever he goes, you know, whether it's in Harlem or on college campuses or overseas, you know, the Black Power mixtape documentary has great footage of Stokely in Stockholm, Sweden, and other places where he's just being mobbed, you know, whether he's in Cuba and he's mobbed, he's in London and he's mobbed. So people know who Stokely Carmichael is. And really, in the context of the 60s, people were using just his first name, Stokely, you know, and people would know who that was.
And there is an enigmatic quality to his life because there is that rock star persona. And then at the age of 30, he goes away. At the age of 30, he makes a very abrupt decision to leave the United States. What led to that decision and ultimately to really drop out of an atmosphere that was just starting to congeal?
Well, I think it's a dangerous atmosphere, and he actually leaves at 27. By the time he's 27, he leaves the United States. I mean, what's interesting is that there's a couple of things. One, he really had visited Africa, Conakry, Guinea, West Africa. He had met with a couple of huge Pan-Africanist leaders, Kwame Nkrumah, who had been president of Ghana, Sékou Touré, who was president of Guinea. He was interested in having a new base, a new political base. He had always read about Pan-Africanism. He was visiting revolutionaries in both Guinea and Tanzania, but also Cuba, hanging out with Fidel Castro. All this stuff is very intoxicating. He spends weeks and weeks in Algeria. You know, he's meeting up with Algerian revolutionary officials. So, you know, he part of it is the being seduced by the idea of being a global revolutionary and not just a civil rights activist in the United States. And then part of it is pressure from the government. Part of it is pressure. He's under surveillance. He's being harassed. He marries Miriam Makeba in 1968. She's being harassed. She's having a problem getting concerts booked in the United States because of being married to Stokely Carmichael. So part of it is sort of survival as well. And when we think about things congealing here, one thing I would say is that I think if he had stayed in the United States, it's very likely that he would have been killed. So I do think that, you know, longevity in your own life has something to do with this. He's not one of the martyrs of the 60s. Dr. King was killed at 39. Malcolm X was assassinated at 39. Stokely leaves at 27. But I think if he had tried to stay in the mix, connected to the Black Panther Party, organizing, doing rallies and public speeches, I don't necessarily think he would have sort of survived the decade and into the early 70s.
It is interesting to note how his supporters reacted to his leaving, though.
Yeah, supporters were, you know, many supporters were angry. Some people understood, but the feeling was that the United States was the front line and leaving, was sort of abandoning the movement. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's what it was.
And did he ever come to terms with that in the sense of understanding that or even trying to put it into some sort of context?
Well, I think, you know, the thing is, some of it you have to read between the lines. I mean, by the time he's Kwame Touré, he becomes a revolutionary political ideologue. One of the things I argue is that, you know, Stokely Carmichael asked all these questions, was much more flexible, very open and expansive, and Kwame Touré had all the answers. You know, scientific socialism, Pan-Africanism, ready for revolution, right? And so from that perspective, publicly, there's no questioning the decision. There's no question. It's saying, look, I'm right. My mentors, Kwame Nkrumah, who dies in 1972, by the time he's 30, Nkrumah dies, which is a big loss for him. Sékou Touré, all this is right. But privately, certainly, I think there had to be some kind of ennui and just some kind of, you know, everybody, right, lives their lives, and by the time you get older, there are some regrets. You'd be inhuman not to have some regrets. So I think that there's a point where he must have had some, you know, and he talks a little bit about it in his own autobiography when after Sekou Touré dies of a heart attack in 84, and there's a revolution against the revolution, and he's put in jail for a short period of time in 86, you know, he's contemplating leaving Guinea just for a split second. He said so, you know, for a split second. But he doesn't. He stays through. So certainly there had to be some kind of reflection. But publicly, no. Publicly, he is going to argue and maintain a strong position that, you know, he is here for the right reasons, and the Pan-African Revolution is the next step. That's what needs to be done.
As author and biographer, what do you hope ultimately the takeaway is for those of us who explore this man's life?
Well, I think the takeaway is a couple of things. One is providing a context, a fuller understanding of the civil rights movement and the Black Power era. So the heroic period of the civil rights movement and the Black Power period that followed it isn't just a linear story without its complexities and its curves and its real sort of panoramic shape. And I think Stokely is a big part of that. I think he also gives you an example of a different kind of well-lived life, because in our contemporary period, a well-lived life is really predicated on material success. You know, Harvard, Yale. It's very, very specific, right? You make tens of millions of dollars, and you're more celebrated than you are. You're celebrated, but you're not necessarily somebody who's done some major contributions or even spoken truth to power. Because one of the things that Stokely's life shows you is, you know, you can live a well-lived life, and you're not always going to be popular by doing that. You can speak truth to power. When you criticize social injustice, there are costs, but he was willing to take those costs. So I think it gives us a different perspective on the 60s and our contemporary period too, because there's a great anecdote where, you know, Barack Obama recalls seeing Kwame Ture at Columbia in the 80s, and you know, the line he says in his book Dreams from My Father is that Ture's eyes glowed inward, the eyes of a madman or a saint. And what that undermines is really the way in which Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture provided a context for Obama, in the sense of and Carmichael would have criticized Obama's drone strikes and the wars and all these things, but he provided a space. These are unintended consequences of the activism of that period, right? And me, even as a professor studying his life, he didn't realize in Mississippi in 1964 that somebody's going to be writing and publishing a biography of him, you know, 50 years later, right? So an unintended consequence is that though that activism and that movement was so important that we're studying it, you know, a half a century later and writing about it, and, you know, we're teaching students about it because of how it impacts, American democracy, how it impacts social movements, citizenship, the way in which we live now, and not just locally, nationally, but also globally. So I think his life is a very, very important prism from which to view a post-war, you know, American and global history.
Peniel Joseph is the author of the new biography, Stokely, A Life. It is published by Basic Books. Peniel Joseph, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Stokely, A Life. It's published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.